This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, coming from Tantalk Radio Network studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. At the bottom of the hour, I have a really interesting author. I was so surprised when I got this book because it's not normally the type of book that I do, but I said, what the heck, this sounds fun, and I was so happy that Ramin Sethuda is going to be here, and he's going to be talking about a funny book called Ladies Who Punch, and it is The Ladies from The View. So it should be interesting. He spent a lot of time talking to these ladies, and that means he has a lot more patience than I do, but it's going to be fun to talk to him. But right now, I want to welcome to the program somebody whose work I have admired before in other books, and this new book that she's written is really fantastic. Andrea Warren has written a book called Enemy Child, the story of Norman Mineta, a boy imprisoned in a Japanese-American internment camp during World War II. Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
Wow. It's
nice to be here.
Well, it's so nice to talk to you because I must say the new book is absolutely beautiful. What a production they've done on that book.
I agree with you. Yes, the production values are very high.
Really the highest, and it's the type of book that you want to put on your coffee table and just pick up, and when visitors come, they'll pick it up and they'll say, wow, this is just a gorgeous book. You know, it's always so much fun because, you know, so often we get books that are just, you know, paperback but then when we get something that's really divine. This is how I say, I love this publisher.
Yes, I would agree with that too.
Oh, wow. Well, of course, it is so nice to talk to you about this book, and we'll mention then afterwards, we'll let you have a little bit of time to talk about your other books. But this book about Norman Mineta is an important book because it tells a story that some people don't know and some people don't understand. So let's just jump right into it, and you tell us about Norman and how you got involved in his story.
Well, this wasn't a story I went looking for. With a couple of my books, this one and one other, the story has found me. Something has impacted me because of an experience, and my response to that is, I need to write about this. I write for young audiences, ages 10 and up. That goes right on through senior citizens. But in terms of the topics and the vocabulary that's in the book and so forth, that's about where I started, age 10. So upper elementary, middle school, high school. I was in Cody, Wyoming several years ago, completing research on my last book, which was called The Boy Who Became Buffalo Bill, Growing Up Billy Cody in Bleeding, Kansas. So clearly I needed to get to Cody, Wyoming, the town that Buffalo Bill founded, and work in the archives there at the museum. And I saw an announcement for what was called an interpretive center at the Heart Mountain War Relocation Center. I had to think about this for a minute. You know, it was showing a picture on this display board of all of these barracks out on this just sort of barren plain. It looked very Wyoming-ish. And a war relocation center, and then it clicked. Ah, that's what they called the Japanese-American internment camps. Well, I had never visited one. I'd never thought much about them. What I knew about them, I had never studied them in school, but I read Snow Falling on Cedars and ran into the information there, and there were several other books, but that's basically what I knew, was through literature. So I finished my research early that day, got the directions on how to find this place, and drove out there. It was about 13 miles from Cody. And as you approach it, this mountain starts to come into view. And there are other mountains, but this one is much bigger. And that's Heart Mountain. And that was the name given to this camp that's in the shadow of Heart Mountain War Relocation Center. And the camp itself, the plain is barren now. I mean, there were 500 barracks there at one time, 10,000 people who were interned there. Now they have this interpretive center that's made to look like several barracks joined together, and inside were lots of displays. And I felt this increasing sense of almost being overwhelmed by what I was learning about the families who were there and what the living conditions were and how they got through that experience. Many of them were interned for 3 years. They started that process in the late winter of the winter of 1941-42. So within a couple of months of Pearl Harbor, they were already starting these roundups and deportations. And Norm's family didn't go until May of that year, but of 1942. But it was just kind of random as they worked their way up and down the West Coast doing this, they being the government. And the government created this corridor along the West Coast, a 50-mile inland from the Pacific Ocean, and if you lived in that area and you were Japanese American, then you were interned. Japanese Americans who lived in other parts of the country basically weren't bothered. I'm sure a lot of them were undergoing a lot of scrutiny, and there were probably incidents of vandalism and that kind of thing, but they were not put into camps. So this is where the story started, just going out there, visiting the place where this happened, seeing these displays about what it was like to be one of those people. And in that visit, and it wasn't a very long visit because I was there toward the end of the day, I learned about Norman Mineta, that he'd been in the camp, and that he'd had this special friendship with Alan Simpson. They met when they were both Boy Scouts while Norm was in the camp, that later they came together in Congress and together introduced and worked very hard to get passed the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, requiring the government to formally apologize to the Japanese Americans for what had happened, and attached to that was a restitution of $20,000 for each Japanese American who'd been interned who was still alive.
Well, it is such a touching story, and it is really quite incredible that the two of them would know each other as children, and then later on in Congress, it's the entire story is inspiring. Now, so let's step back. Now you've discovered that Norman was in the camps. How did you get to him? Because I understand that he had been approached many times by people who wanted to tell his story.
Yes, and he has told bits and pieces of it in the past. I mean, there are several anecdotes, and there's also the story of his friendship with Alan Simpson that's very well known. In fact, recently CBS Sunday Morning did a segment just on that, the friendship between the two men, because they are still very close friends today. And he wasn't easy to get in touch with. I couldn't find him on the Internet at all. I started through the clerk of the House of Representatives, because Norm had served there for so long. They can't give out that information. I tried several organizations he was affiliated with. I began with the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles, where he's on the Board of Trustees, and same thing. You know, everybody was very polite about it, but they just didn't feel it was their place to hand over that contact information. When I finally did reach Norm, it was because the director of another organization said, you know, I think this is important, and what I will do is I will reach out and see if he will then contact you. So that's what I had to settle for, and that's what ended up working. But he's always said no, as you said, because he just wasn't going to participate in any commercial ventures, and he never felt, this is so typically Norm, that his own story was more important than anybody else's, and so why should he be singled out? But when finally this contact was made with me, what happened was his assistant called me, and Norm is 87, but he's still very, very active on many committees in Washington, D.C., and internationally, and travels a great deal still, and so busy, busy man, busy, busy schedule. And she called me just to visit with me for a couple of minutes, I think to kind of the, you know, who I was and what I did. And I said, what I'd like to do is write him a letter and send him a couple of my books and just tell him what I'm interested in doing. So I got an address that way, sent the book, sent the letter. And a few weeks later, I got another call from the assistant saying, Norm would like to speak to you. And he couldn't do it right then, but we set up a time. And he called me, and we chatted on the phone. And, you know, he was very thoughtful. He was very friendly. And he said, I've looked at your books. I've read them. I really like them. And you write for the audience I want to reach. You know, it's very, very important that young people understand what happened and why. They clearly are the ones who are going to have to become the guardians of making sure this doesn't happen again. And he agreed to it. So then I was turned back over to the assistant to figure out a time. And it turned out to be several months in the future before we could get together. And that was okay. I needed that much prep time. I was still finishing this other book and had a lot of research to do to be ready to talk to Norm. So I traveled to his home. He lives in the Annapolis, Maryland area, and I'm in Kansas City. And I booked my flight for 4 days and spent 3 of those days in Norma Mineta's kitchen, sitting at the table with my tape recorder between us and my notebook full of questions. His wife, Denny, was just lovely. She kept us supplied with food. Norm's great at making coffee. We had plenty of coffee. And we'd go out to dinner in the evenings, and we just spent those days talking. And, of course, there was a lot of follow-up after that when I had other questions, when I would send him what I was writing, and that would trigger a memory. And, of course, he was fact-checking all the way along the line, too. And, you know, Norm had never written his own story. Again, there have been many, many offers from publishers, again, because of this feeling that he was no more important than anybody else. He was just one piece of all of this. And he also has dyslexia, so those kinds of tasks are more difficult for him. So he just had never done it.
Well, I'm sure that one of the books that persuaded him to work with you, to want to work with you, was your book, Escape from Saigon, How a Vietnam War Orphan Became an American Boy, which I had read before because I happened to know somebody who adopted a Vietnamese child. And so it was a subject that I had always been interested in. And I'm sure when he read that book and saw how beautifully you write and how you're exactly right, that you write, it's funny, you write at a level that a 10-year-old can enjoy and really get into the book, but any adult can also find so much depth in the book. It's, you know, you are really a fantastic writer, so I can see why he would select you to work with.
I appreciate that. I did send him Escape from Saigon. I also sent him Orphan Train Rider, One Boy's True Story, and I sent him Surviving Hitler, A Boy in the Nazi Death Camps. These are all three stories that, well, they're about boys, but that wasn't the main part of it. Boys who'd been through especially hard things, two of them experiences with war. And for me to do the books the way I want to do, I think my strongest books are the ones where I've been able to interview the person. The person's still alive. And I just can almost burrow in behind their eyeballs, looking out at the world as they did, so that readers truly identify with them and go through this experience with them. And I felt that this story could be another one like that if I found the right main character to write about, my protagonist. Norm certainly filled that bill.
Well, now you're writing, you know, doesn't just cover him. It covers also the general World War II overall view of what was going on. You do a lot of research because there's more than just sometimes, you know, a story about a famous person will be just their story. But you bring so much more to the game.
Yes. Now, I very much am telling the story of history. You know, the whole idea here, I'm a former classroom teacher. That's where I started my career, and I think that shows up constantly because what I want young readers to do is to learn the history, but to do it in a palatable way so they don't even know they're doing it. They get very caught up in the story of the main person, and they want to know, well, why did this happen? You know, what is the history behind this? And, of course, today they have so many resources because of the Internet to find out this information. I mean, they don't even have to go to the library like I did when I was young. And then there are a lot of questions. So I have to be selective because there have been whole books written on nothing but, let's say, the 442nd, you know, the group of Japanese American men who fought in World War II, books on the internment experience, books on individual camps. So there's so much history. You know, it's hard to boil it down in a way that it doesn't become intrusive, so that you can continue to enjoy the story and absorb the history. So there's a real balancing act that goes on with this.
Well, what were some of the most touching stories that he shared with you and that you have put in the book? Things that really perhaps brought tears to your eyes, too.
Well, I think that one of the things that it was very necessary for me to understand, I had visited Japan several years ago, spent 3 weeks there, and I have a friend here in Kansas City who was born in one of the camps, a trusted doctor who's Japanese but lives here in the United States. And so I had a fairly good foundation of the Japanese, let's call it, view of life and how they are able to accept things. I've always been interested in the martial arts. I've actually had some training myself. Have always loved the Kurosawa movies, you know, that kind of thing. And so when you start putting it all together and you sort of understand this Zen approach of accepting things that happen to you, and finding your way through them, making the best of things, of keeping your troubles to yourself. There are two sides of this. All of those are such positive qualities, but when you start talking about keeping troubles to yourself, the Japanese Americans did their very best to get through this experience with as much dignity as they could, but at the end of it felt such shame that, you know, it led to decades of silence, where they wouldn't even, the older Japanese Americans wouldn't even talk to their children about it, much less their grandchildren. And Norm found, you know, when he was first, this whole experience was starting, that he just couldn't get his parents to express their own fears, much less help him deal with his fears. And so he was taking his major concerns about this to his own friends who were going through the same thing. And they would talk about it together and try to reason through it. But they were very worried. I mean, they stopped doing things like going to the movies because it just was too hard to have fun. Excuse me. It's allergy season in Kansas City here. Big time. So those are the parts that were hard for me. You know, I just wish he had a very loving family. He had the best parents. But that whole Japanese thing just made that a little bit harder for a boy who at age 10 was trying to understand what was going on and was feeling isolated.
Well, I love the inclusion of the photographs and the other documents that you have in the book.
Well, I do the photo research. It's certainly gotten easier with the Internet. I didn't have that for a number of my books. And Norm had certain family photos. You know, the hard part, what lacks in this, and I've run into this before with books I've written, his father's camera was confiscated before they went to the camps. They, like, radios were considered contraband, you know, something that could be used to help the Japanese in an invasion. So they were not allowed to take them into the camps. Now, there were some cameras in the camps, and I've never been able to really track back on those stories. I don't know if they were smuggled in or delivered later by friends or whatever, but Norm's father didn't have a camera while they were in the camp. And so there's only one photo, and it is in the book, that shows Norm and his parents at Heart Mountain. And I've filled in with lots of other photos. The government, a couple of times, allowed professional photographers into the camps, and so there are pictures, you know, to illustrate things. Just Norm's not in them. He's in the earlier ones and obviously lots in the later, but not the camp experience itself.
Now, what were his most, his memories? When he talked about it, how did he feel? Was he angry still at what happened to him?
Well, what has always weighed on Norm and what has directed his entire career was that one of the first things the government did after Pearl Harbor, actually beginning on Pearl Harbor Day, war with Japan didn't come as a surprise, nor did war with Italy and Germany. And our government, long before the war was declared against those countries, had already started lists of people they considered suspect. And so on Pearl Harbor Day, the FBI and other law enforcement agencies too, but it was driven by the FBI, swooped into the Japanese-American communities along the Pacific coast and arrested the leaders. Now, their definition of a leader was anybody who was in charge of something. So it could have been the local jujitsu teacher or the Shinto priest or Norm's next-door neighbor, Mr. Hirano, who was president of a social organization. It also included business people and anybody in any kind of, a council position or something like that, and pastors, that sort of thing. They left Norm's father alone, probably because he was just simply too well connected to the white community. He was good friends with the president of the local university and with the mayor and that kind of thing. He knew the sheriff. And so they left him alone, but he was a rare exception. So with their leadership immediately taken, these people who were arrested, and it's men and women, mostly men, were sent off to high-detention security prisons. The Hirano's neighbor next door, again, president of a social organization, was sent 2,000 miles away to North Dakota to a prison. His family were not even informed of his whereabouts for 2 months and didn't see him for over 2 years. I mean, this man did nothing. And this was real typical of what happened. So it's exactly like what Hitler did with the Jews. You know, you take away the leadership, and then there's nobody to speak up for you. There's nobody to organize you. There's nobody to defend you. And this is how the Japanese Americans were. I mean, they didn't have any leadership. And so they're sent off to the camps, and they have no way to protest it. And there was some pushback in some of the camps, but mostly they did their Japanese American, you know, the Zen approach of, if this is what the government
getting
needs
through
to
it.
Do, we'll do it.
Well, yeah. Andrea, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. You have written a very important book for children, and I hope that it turns up in every school library in the country, because it is something that children should read, but I think also parents out there. This is a wonderful book to get for your child during the summer. It's something you might want to read with them, and it certainly is a beautifully done book. Andrea is a brilliant writer, and the production values of this book are among the best. And it's called Enemy Child, The Story of Norman Mineta, a Boy Imprisoned in a Japanese-American Internment Camp During World War II. And it's available wherever books are sold. And Andrea, again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay. We're going to go to commercial, and then I'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author? An artist? an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
From the author of gut-wrenching novels Guns Up and Gunner's Glory, now a gut-wrenching comedy, Section 8. One fan writes, Section 8 is inspired insanity. Johnny Clark should receive the Pulitzer Prize and his commitment papers in the same ceremony. You will laugh till it hurts. Section 8. It's 1946, and President Harry Truman has two goals in life. Dump the U.S. Marine Corps and get reelected. Can he convince Congress that the Marine Corps is obsolete? He'll try, but first he wants to use them one last time. There's something he needs them to do. A little mission to China to steal something that one of his contributors need. It's dangerous, but who cares? Marines are expendable, or so he thinks. What could possibly go wrong? A lawsuit by the Vatican? An attempted assassination by a dead assassin? Flamethrower sermons? If that's not enough, there's a missing A-bomb. This book has it all, even a love story. Remember, Section 8 is only a temporary state. You Hope, written by a true American hero. You'll love this book, now available on Amazon. So get it today. Section 8 by Johnny Clark. Semper Fi.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back with a very fascinating guest. Ramin Setudah has written a book called Ladies Who Punch. Wow, what a title and what a book. Hi, Ramin.
Hi, thank you very much for having me on.
Okay, well, you know, it's funny. I almost didn't do this book because I really don't know the program very well. I'm actually, you know, I'm always working. So, but I thought, first of all, I discovered it's your first book, right?
It is my first book. That's right. You're on air probably at the same time the show is on.
Exactly.
And I grew up watching the show with my mom. She loved the show. It was a really important show to her, and she really liked watching The View. And then when I became a journalist, I started writing about the show and covering the show. And out of all the different topics that I've ever written about as a journalist, the one thing people are most interested in, truthfully, is stories about The View. It touches a nerve, and it's an important show in our culture.
Absolutely. So I said to myself, well, first of all, I always love to be on with a guest on their first day, the release date of their first book, because it's part of history. So now I'm part of your history forever. And
thank you.
And I think it's always so exciting when that first book comes out, and of course it comes out on a Tuesday. And so let's just jump right into it, because as I said, having, you know, absolutely no spare time, I was a homeschool mom for many years, and with piano lessons and violin lessons and this, I'm like running around all the time. So tell us about Ladies Who Punch, the explosive inside story of The View. How did you get involved with it in the first place? Other than your mother, you watch it with your mother, and then you grow up to be a famous journalist, and you come back to The View.
So I wrote about the show a lot when I was a reporter at Newsweek, and also in my current job as a reporter at Variety. And I spent the last 3 years working on this book. I interviewed more than 150 people associated with the show for this book, including many of the co-hosts, everyone from Barbara Walters to Rosie O'Donnell, Meredith Vieira, Star Jones, Jenny McCarthy, and really got an insider's look at what happened on the show and why this show was so influential and important to our culture and to so many women who watch daytime TV.
Wow. And do all of them still like you?
Well, what I set out to do from the very beginning was to be a fair journalist. And I was very upfront with everyone about how this was going to be an encyclopedic look at the show. And I wanted everyone's perspective, and I would go back and I'd fact-check things that other people said, and I was very thorough in my research and in my fact-checking methods.
So tell us, how did The View start? Who were the first participants? And tell us about the very, very beginning of the program, and how was it received in those days? What was the start date then? I forget now.
This was in 1997. This was Barbara Walters' idea. And she decides to do a very groundbreaking show at the time, to have herself on the show as a news anchor and to also have other co-hosts on the show expressing their opinions. In addition to delivering the news and talking about the news, they were also going to talk about their opinions, which wasn't done back in the 90s, and certainly not for anchors of Barbara Walters' level. And the original cast of the show had to be a cast of essentially unknowns because the show, you know, no one had big visions or dreams for the show. So it was Barbara Walters. They found Meredith Vieira, who later went on to anchor the Today Show, Joy Behar, who is a comedian and now, of course, is synonymous with the show, Star Jones, who was a former prosecutor, and Debbie Matenopoulos, who was a 22-year-old college student who had zero broadcasting experience and knew very little about television. But Barbara liked her because she thought they needed a young person on the show and appreciated the young person's dynamic on the show.
Well, I found her interesting because, you know, like when I started my radio program, I had no experience. I didn't know anything about radio. And so I found her very interesting.
Right, but at least you weren't sitting next to Barbara Walters every day, because that's a very intimidating thing for someone starting out.
Yeah.
And so Debbie wasn't given the room to grow or to learn or to sort of come into her own, and she was the first person that the show fired about a year and a half into her being on the show, and that fanned a lot of the intrigue. People were curious about what Debbie had done to get herself fired, and they had a contest where they were allowing viewers to come on and try out to be on The View. And that helped make the show very popular because it kind of tapped into this thing that American Idol later did very successfully, which was anybody, in the same way that anybody could be a pop star on American Idol, there was this idea that you could all be co-hosts of The View. And a lot of women watched to see who they would end up choosing, and they chose Lisa Ling, who was a very serious journalist.
Now, let's sort of run through them, because, you know, as I said, I don't know all of them, but let's start with Star Jones. What happened to Star Jones?
Yes. So Star Jones was the most relatable, the most liked. Viewers really, really appreciated her at first. And she made a huge mistake, which was that she used the show to promote her wedding. And she was getting all these wedding freebies.
Oh.
And so as a result of that, her perception in the public plummeted. The viewers no longer liked her. Barbara Walters had to make the difficult decision to fire her from the show 9 years into her tenure on the show. So in 2006, Star Jones was fired on The View. And as a result of that, she surprised Barbara Walters by quitting live on television. And it was you know, a very dramatic day in the history of the show.
Yeah, I do remember that, seeing it on the news, because I was thinking at the time, well, Star Jones is a lawyer. She should know better than to take freebies.
Right. And she hadn't, you know, she was, the public really liked Star, and they really were rooting for her. But when she did that, I think it really changed her standing.
Well, let's talk about Meredith Vieira. She went on to big things.
She did. She went on to a big contract at the Today Show. Meredith was, I think, one of my favorite people to interview. And the thing about Meredith is she's exactly how you'd imagine her to be. She's wonderful and supportive and collegial, and she was everyone's favorite co-host. All the producers loved her the best, and I really enjoyed interviewing her.
And now, when exactly did Whoopi become involved?
So Whoopi Goldberg came on in 2007. So she's been on the show for 12 years. She was brought on to be the moderator. We didn't really think of Whoopi as someone who would be on daytime TV. She was you know, an EGOT. She had won many awards. She was an Oscar-winning actress. But the show gave her a new chapter in her career. And being on the show allowed her to have this financial safety net. So she had this, she has this very comfortable salary on The View, and then she's free to do her other side projects, which is one of the reasons why she likes doing the show.
Now, of course, the big controversy came along with Rosie, right?
It did, yes, it did.
So Rosie
was the queen of daytime. She was as powerful at one point as Oprah Winfrey on daytime TV, and she had a very successful talk show that ran for six seasons starting in 1996. She decided to step away from that talk show, and when Meredith Vieira left The View to go do Today, Barbara Walters needed a solution. And so she approaches Rosie O'Donnell, asks if Rosie will come on board The View and try it out for a year, thinking that this could save the show. And in some ways it did, because it made the show very relevant and heated and something that a lot of people watched. But it also became very dramatic, because Rosie started to want to take over the show from Barbara, and she wanted to run it her way, and Barbara had her own way of running the show. And I chronicle what happened during that year, and it was a very tumultuous and difficult year for everyone.
It's a great chapter, I tell you. There's a lot going on in that one chapter, and I thought, yeah, I think I better talk about this book, because I think people will enjoy it. I think, Ramin, you've done a great job, and I looked at the back cover, and, you know, you look like the kind of guy who's writing, a mystery thriller or something, and so that you're writing about all these women and that you managed to survive all these interviews, I said, more credit to him. That's great. So
thank you very much. And also, Mother's Day is coming up, and a lot of moms really love The View, not only mine, but a lot of moms out there love The View, and I think this would be a really great gift for a lot of moms out there.
I agree. It would be they will just love it, because there's so much going on in every chapter. Like, whoa. So it really is a wonderful book. You've done a beautiful job of writing it, and I want to thank you so much for being on the program on Joy on Paper today, because it's a joy to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye, Ramin. Look forward to your next book.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay. Good. Okay. We're going to go to we're going to go to a book buzz right now. Okay.
This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz. A suspenseful, insightful, and beautifully written story, Margaret George, New York Times bestselling author of The Splendor Before the Dark, a novel of the Emperor Nero, is talking about Antonius, Son of Rome, by author Brooke Allen. Here's the buzz. After young Marcus Antonius's father dies in disgrace, he yearns to restore his family's honor during the final days of Rome's dying republic. Marcus is rugged, handsome, and has abundant military talent, but upon entering manhood, he falls prey to the excesses of a violent society. Through a series of personal tragedies, Marcus must come into his own. Desperate to redeem his name and carve a legacy for himself, he refuses to let warring rebels, scheming politicians, or even an alluring young Egyptian princess stand in his way. This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper. Start reading Antonius, Son of Rome by author Brooke Allen today. For more of my suggestions on the books you should not miss, go to our webpage, www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and click on Book Buzz. That's radio-joyonpaper. Rita Moreau, buzzing off for now.
I've been so excited with this book for the past few weeks, and it's been keeping me busy, because it is a cookbook, and it is absolutely fantastic. The author's name is Sahara Rose Kitabi, and the foreword for this book is written by no other than Deepak Chopra, and the name of the book is Eat, Feel Fresh. And I am so happy to welcome you to the program, Sahara.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Patsy. It's a pleasure.
Well, I love this book. It is, first, it's so beautiful. And you are so beautiful in the book. There are lots of photos of you. It is a marvelous cookbook.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
But it is so much more than that, because you have to tell us why. It is also a cookbook that you can take and really change your life.
Yes. So for me, food is something so much more than just what we eat, so much more than calories, but really it changes the fabric of our being. And Ayurveda is a health system, but it looks at the mind and the body as interconnected. So the foods you eat impact the way that you feel. And each of us has a unique mind-body type that we were born with. Some of us are born more airy, which is more creative, inspired, able to think outside the box. But on the other side, maybe we have a lot of ideas and things that we want to do that we don't really come around to. We may suffer from anxiety, insomnia. This is the dosha, the mind-body type that I had that led me to Ayurveda. Some of us are more fiery. We are ambitious, hardworking, organized, disciplined, structured. But sometimes when life doesn't go our way, we can become frustrated and agitated and just annoyed. And the other side of that is that you can also really direct your direction the way that you want to be going. So there's both sides for each body type. And then the last one is Kapha, the earth type. And these are people who are calm, grounded, peaceful, loving. They often put other people in front of themselves, which can lead to sometimes burning yourself out and bending over backwards for people. And when you're giving off all this energy to others, then you're not filling up your own cup. And oftentimes that leads to emotional eating and weight gain, feeling lethargic and tired. So the foods in this recipe book are not just for your physical body, but they can change these exact personality traits to make you more balanced.
And the beautiful thing about this, I love healthy cookbooks written by somebody who knows what it's like to not eat healthy, because there was a time in your life where junk food might have been played a part. And so I think it's always nice when somebody comes, if they've been healthy all their life, and then you say, oh, well, they don't understand what it's like to eat a dozen donuts, for example.
Oh, yeah, I know what that's like. I know what all of that's like. And that's why I needed it, because I grew up eating so much junk food, and I eventually was overweight. I had really bad allergies that turned into asthma. I wasn't able to even play outside as a kid because I would get such bad asthma attacks that I'd have to go to the emergency room. I spent many Mother's Days in the emergency room. So no doctor had ever told me my allergies were related to the foods I was eating. But when I shifted my diet since then, I've never had an asthma attack or allergies.
Well, you know, Ayurveda is such an interesting concept because it has been here for almost forever, because it is so ancient. And long before anybody was thinking about eating healthy, Ayurveda was here. And somewhere along the line, we got all this processed food in our systems. So tell us a little bit about the history of Ayurveda and why it is so important. By the way, I love how you talk about the alkaline. You have the alkaline chart in there, which is really, really important in good eating.
Yes. So Ayurveda is the world's oldest health system, and it's the sister science of yoga. And it really looks, again, at the mind-body connection. And the practices in Ayurveda have been tried and true for thousands of years, but we needed a modern upgrade. And that's because our food system is so different from that of even 50 years ago, let alone 5,000 years ago. We're exposed to so many more toxins, GMOs, pesticides, hormones. So we need to further alkalize our diets. Alkaline foods are foods that are going to make you more balanced in your pH levels. And an acidic environment is what causes diseases. So most of us, our pH levels are a little bit too acidic, and we need to move more towards alkaline. Alkalizing foods are fruits, vegetables, things that naturally grow from the earth. So it's not just Ayurveda, but looking at it with modern nutritional science and how we can alkalize our diet to boost up serotonin, the happiness hormone, which is stored in our gut, and really showing that the way that you digest is the way that you feel.
In fact, they've proven in the past few years that it is the gut bacteria that really makes a difference of whether you lose weight or don't lose weight.
Yes. And yes, absolutely. Most people are missing that. They're trying to eat all the right foods, but they haven't resolved their gut and digestive issues. And it's even related to autism and many other mental diseases, depression. All of this can really be solved by going into your gut and seeing what the issue is there.
The wonderful thing about this cookbook is you use some, you know, modern ingredients, but yet your recipes are so, so good. I can't tell which one is the best, but that roasted cauliflower and lentil tacos has to be one of the best.
I wanted to make foods that people are familiar with. Tacos, pizza, pancakes, brownies, foods that we love, foods that we're not willing to let go of, nor should we. But how can we upgrade those? How can we make them more alkaline, gluten-free, plant-based, and make them right for our dosha? So I've included spices like ginger, which is really good for metabolism, cumin, which is really good if you have a hard time digesting beans, which a lot of us do. It helps eliminate the gas buildup that happens. So all of these spices can be thrown into your favorite ingredients, your favorite recipes, and it makes it more Ayurvedic as well as more medicinal.
Your mother's Persian, right? Yes. Yeah, so, yeah. So did you find, because I lived in Iran for some years, do you found some influence from her cooking?
Yes, very much so. So when I started to learn about Ayurveda, I was so drawn to this ancient approach to eating, and I realized it was so similar to the way that my grandmother used to eat. She always would tell me, oh, it's cold, don't have this cold salad, it's going to be too cooling for your body. And even in many other cultures, in Latin culture, they have this concept of cooling and warming foods. So it's really not just Ayurvedic, but it is global. And when you look at the energy of foods and you look at the blue zones, the areas around the world with the world's longest lifespans, you see that they're all looking at it in the same way.
Also in this book, everything is so beautiful, and I think that more and more, and it's wonderful, the younger generation I've discovered, they are more into food in having it look beautiful. They have parties, and it's really, they get together, and they have parties, and they like to bring food, and they like to have it look beautiful. And all of this, like the chai bliss balls and some of the desserts, they are so beautiful.
Yeah, I really believe that we eat with our eyes, and when food is delicious and beautiful, we're more likely to want to have more of it. And the great thing about vegetables is they're so colorful, they're so beautiful as they are. So when we can really just keep the intact fruit and vegetable as it is and let that color and that texture shine through, there really isn't that much we need to do.
And I love how you've adapted very, you know, the kind of desserts that people love, like Rice Krispie treats, and put it in a whole new frame and made it into a healthy dessert.
Yeah, of course. You know, we don't want to give up on these things that we've grown up eating. We just want to upgrade them and make them work for today's time. So this isn't a diet. This isn't a new thing you have to go buy new groceries for and put it on your fridge and forget about it a week later. This is really a lifestyle approach.
Well, how exciting was it to, you know, I know when you were young, you became a follower of Deepak Chopra. How exciting is it to be able to meet the person that you've admired so much?
Yeah, I mean, it's still very surreal just because I would always listen to his audiobooks and do his meditations growing up. But it really just shows that I'm on the right path, that I'm able to get someone that I look up to so much support. And just to continue this Ayurvedic knowledge, the knowledge of meditation, bringing it more into the mainstream to help more people.
Well, I think it's a beautiful book, an absolutely wonderful book. This is an ideal book to bring. And while you're at it, bring one of the desserts along because they will really appreciate it. And I think if anybody who's planning a big dinner, to incorporate some of these healthy, beautiful, and absolutely delicious desserts and other side dishes, like the cauliflower casserole. You know, all of these things are just, they work so well.
Yes, they work so well. Well, thank you so much for sharing, and I hope your audience really enjoys it.
I know they will, and I'm going to encourage everyone to get this book, and for all sorts of events, it is a wonderful, wonderful gift. Give it to new brides. Bye-bye now.
I want to thank you for those of you who sent me messages that you did get, you know, you met the deadline and you sent in your self-published books to Writer's Digest competition. But I did appreciate getting these notes from you about how you, you know, how you felt about just trying it, because it's for many of you, it's the first time that you've actually entered a contest. And I know it's scary, and you don't want to get your hopes up, but you get your hopes up no matter what. But it is, as I said, a wonderful opportunity for you. For all of these Writer's Digest contests, keep an eye on them, because they also have specialty ones like mysteries and sci-fi, poetry, separate from the self-published ones. So keep an eye on the contests there, because all of the contests are really, really helpful to you to grow as a writer, because you get back from them an analysis, and it really helps you to see from a literary agent's point of view what they're looking for, and where you fall in your development stage. They are very honest. If they think you need a lot of work, they tell you. And if they just have some easy suggestions, perhaps a changing of point of view, or just wherever they feel that you are deficient, they will tell you. And so I hope that you continue checking out Writer's Digest frequently. Remember what I say, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're lucky, to have those magic words said, lights, camera, action, and your book is turned into a film or a streaming video or perhaps a television series like on Hallmark for Carol J. Perry. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. Wow, it's been an exciting 4 years. And again, thank you all. And my website is radio-joy on paper. Go there and put in a question for Bill Larson. He'll be here next week. Bye-bye now.